From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
I want to create spaces in the Black church where, regardless of your sexual identity or your gender identity, you are affirmed.
Pride in the Pews founder Don Abram. He's working to promote LGBTQI plus inclusion in the American Black church.
Like any kind of bigotry, whether it's racism or the anti-Asian bigotry that we're seeing or the anti-Muslim bigotry that we've seen, anti-Semitism is something that flourishes only when it goes unchallenged.
Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline will be back with an update on the ongoing struggle to defend true religious freedom for all. But first,
despite almost three decades of pushback, yesterday Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed a bill that lifted the ban on yoga in schools, but with specific guidelines like prohibiting the use of the word namaste, which is very odd.
Earlier this year, a classroom ban on the practice of yoga that dates all the way back to 1993 was finally ended by the Alabama State Legislature. While the action underscores the secular health benefits of yoga for students, it also separates it from its religious Hindu context, which some see as cultural appropriation. An articulate opinion piece on this situation was published by Religion News Service under the headline, "Alabama Lifts Ban on Yoga in Schools, Sort of." And I'm happy to welcome the author, Matt McDermott, Senior Director of Communications at the Hindu American Foundation, to State of Belief Radio. Matt, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The Alabama decision happened in March, but that's not the only state dealing with this kind of conundrum. So in a nutshell, why was there a ban on yoga for all of these years in the first place?
My understanding is that there were concerns dating back, you know, many years, that the religious, spiritual Hindu roots of yoga would be brought into Alabama public schools. And there were some in the community that felt that that was a religious imposition upon them. I don't know entirely the history of it, but my understanding was that they were some more conservative Christians who assumed that by teaching yoga in public schools, they would be inculcating their kids with Hindu teachings, Hindu values.
So do you know what led to the lifting of this ban, at least partially in Alabama?
I believe it was instituted, you know, it was brought about by state legislators that wanted to bring in yoga, the physical parts of yoga, the asana practice, into public schools, as it's been done in a number of places across the country. And they just wanted to reform the legislation so that that could be allowed. I don't know the history of what led to that, if there was community outreach that came about that brought that into being. But my understanding is, you know, it was just to let's bring asana practice into public schools because there are numerous well-documented health benefits of this.
Well, some very specific limitations come along with what's allowed in Alabama schools. Can you talk a little bit about that with us?
Sure. the legislation permits the physical postures of yoga, the asanas, to be taught to children. However, they can't be called by their traditional Sanskrit names. They can't be, the classes can't be introduced with the phrase namaste, the word namaste, which is frankly just a traditional greeting in various forms throughout India, though it's often used in yoga classes as a quasi-spiritual greeting. Literally, it is a Hindi Sanskrit version of just saying hello. But that is also prohibited.
Specifically on church state separation grounds, where would you draw the line on offering students a practice that mental health professionals widely endorse?
Teaching yoga in public schools is, as I wrote in the article, it's walking a bit of a tightrope, because the asana practice, if you just are practicing vinyasa yoga, if you're going through sun salutations, doing the different postures, if you leave it at that, doesn't have a religious component. But there is no getting around the fact that yoga as a practice and a philosophy has its roots in Hinduism. Yoga is also practiced in a spiritual context in various forms. There's Buddhist meditation. There are Sikh yoga practitioners. There's a Jain yoga tradition as well. All of the indigenous religions of India have some form of yoga. So if you get into the philosophy and that spiritual aspect in public schools, the line is between teaching about religion and teaching religion. So educators and schools that want to bring in a yoga practice, if they want to stay on the church state separation side, would probably do well to stick with the physical postures of yoga. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, I think that if you mention the tradition, where it comes from, you are probably fine. But once you get into the more philosophical aspects, you're into a gray area or over the line, depending on how it's done.
In your Religion News Service piece, you raise concerns about cultural appropriation. That's the other side of this tricky situation.
It is indeed. The cultural appropriation part comes in to me when you teach the asana and you don't mention where it comes from. I'm not suggesting the public schools in the United States go into a full yoga philosophy course or incorporate that, but divorcing the physical postures from the greater practice, teaching it without giving practitioners some hint that this is part of what it is. The physical postures, for listeners that don't know, are one of eight limbs of yoga traditionally. They're ethical foundations, they're breathing practices, there's meditative practices, and so on. And the physical postures are just one part. If you mention that it's part of that and acknowledge where it comes from, I think that you can walk that tightrope between cultural appropriation and falling foul of church-state separation. The cultural appropriation part comes in when, as we've seen in some yoga studios over the years, I have to say, I think it's getting slightly better in studios acknowledging this, but there is a negative aspect to when a studio just offers the physical postures of yoga and never mentions that where this comes from. They treat it as simply an exercise class. And the asana is exercise. You get a very good workout if you do it consistently and with some, you know, vigorous attention to it. But if you don't know where that's coming from, you really run the risk of cultural appropriation at worst, I think.
Matt, do you have a model for offering young people the benefits of yoga while avoiding both the promotion of religion issue and the cultural appropriation issue?
I wish. Maybe HAF should develop a specific course. It's not something that we've gotten into. We have mostly weighed in on issues of cultural appropriation, trying to, I don't like to use the phrase, but thought leaders on how schools can do this, weigh in on how, because a number of us at HAF are yoga practitioners. Myself, at least three or four other members of staff regularly practice yoga and have for many years. So we want to see kids get the benefit of this. We have personally seen the benefits of this, but we're also very sensitive to legitimate concerns about public schools teaching a religious system. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a specific, you know, toolbox or guidelines. As I said, I think maybe we could develop that. But as I said before, as long as the physical postures are taught And I would say the breathing exercises too, because there's not, one can get the benefits of that without necessarily practicing the other parts of it or engaging with the philosophical, spiritual components of it. But if you stick to that and mention where it comes from without getting into that, I think you're on the right side of it. Now, some people may say that that too, you know, decouples the tradition a little bit. And I have some sympathy to that. But we have to work with what we, you know, with the legal system that we have in the United States, so kids can get the benefit of this while the tradition is respected as much as it can within those limitations.
As other states and communities weigh these questions, what would you encourage them to keep in mind?
I think schools wishing to practice, offer the practice of yoga to their kids should really, again, keep in mind where the tradition comes from. Know that you're talking about a tradition that is very old. It's not static. It's been evolving over thousands of years. But if you go back thousands of years in carvings and inscriptions and textual mentions, yoga is there. Parts of it are there. So you're engaging in that tradition. But at the same time, stick to the physical parts, stick to the breathing parts. I believe the law comes down on if you want to, if schools want to offer their facilities for a more extensive instruction in yoga, they are capable of doing so. But as part of a physical education class or something that kids can't opt out of, or that's done during regular classroom time, you have to stick to the physical parts, the breathing exercises. Otherwise, parents may have a legitimate issue with, you know, separation of church and state.
Well, I don't want to let you go until we let our listeners know how they can follow and get involved in the work of the Hindu American Foundation, if they wish. It's a good organization. Tell them a little bit about how they can know it.
Sure. If listeners want to find out more about HAF, they can go to our website, www.hinduamerican.org. You can follow us on social media. Everywhere we are at Hindu American. We're quite active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. If you want to find out more, you can go to any of those places.
Matt McDermott is Senior Director of Communications at the Hindu American Foundation. His opinion piece, Alabama Lifts Ban on Yoga in Schools, sort of, was published by Religion News Service, and we'll link to that on stateofbelief.com. Matt, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Don Abram, founder of Pride in the Pews, and later, Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. As we stand on the threshold of June, traditionally observed as LGBTQI plus Pride Month, we couldn't wait to get started on our coverage of faith-related stories impacting this community. And so I am happy to be joined right now by Don Abram, who heads up the grassroots initiative called Pride in the Pews. Don, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here.
Well, tell our listeners right off what Pride in the Pews is all about.
Put simply, Pride in the Pews is a grassroots nationwide effort to make the Black church more inclusive of LGBTQIA plus Christians. We do that by creating culturally relevant content, leveraging Black church history and Black religious traditions to really meet churches where they are, and to provide them with the tools and the resources needed to create more affirming environments of all of those who are on the margins, with particular focus on LGBTQIA plus identifying Christians.
How did this project get started?
Well, how much time do you have? You know, if I had to trace the origins, it would go back to my childhood church on the far south side of Chicago. I grew up in a hand clapping, toe tapping Black church. And at the age of 14, I embraced my calling to preach. And at the same time, I acknowledged my own queerness. What was abundantly clear, almost instinctively, to me was that I could not embody both identities without forfeiting my right to ministry and to community. But after matriculating through Harvard Divinity School and engaging in deep, intensive study of scripture, I realized that my faith not only gave me permission to embody my queerness and my calling, but demanded that I embody both as I fight for all marginalized communities. So Pride in the Pews really began through my own experience. And I decided to really embark on this larger, more extensive and sustainable effort to make Black churches more inclusive after the George Floyd protests. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to really present the Black church an opportunity to reaffirm its commitment to pursuing justice for all of God's children, especially LGBTQIA plus Christians. I'm sure you know this, and perhaps even your listeners, but the Black church has really stood on the front lines of fighting for social justice historically. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to LGBTQIA plus issues, it has really stood on the sidelines, not really affirming the humanity or sanctity of Black queer lives. So the racial reckoning, as I see it, even as it continues to unfold, really gives the opportunity for the Black church to expand its public advocacy to include LGBTQIA plus Christians.
So you didn't just step into this and say, oh, I'll just try this. You got in because you thought this is where you belong.
Yes, absolutely. My faith called me to this place, but more importantly, the radical liberating tradition of the Black church calls me to this. When we think about the history of the Black church, it started in the antebellum South, wherein slaves gathered to come together and affirm one another and to advance a gospel that was on the side of the oppressed. For me, fighting for LGBTQIA rights from the perspective of the Black church is an extenuation of that tradition.
Hmm. Queering the Black church one testimony at a time. What a powerful statement. Now, how does that work in practice?
In practice, it means listening to the voices and lived experiences of LGBTQIA plus folks. And we're doing that with Pride in the Pews through a project that we are calling the Can I Get a Witness Project. We are interviewing LGBTQIA plus Christians from across the country, asking them about their experiences, both good, bad, and indifferent, with the Black church. And our hope is that by listening to the folks who are on the ground in the pews of Black churches, we'll be able to harness the wisdom inherent in those stories to create culturally relevant curricula. So we are lifting up those stories, harnessing the wisdom inherent in them, and coming up with practical, concrete tools that Black churches can use to become more affirming.
Don, we've highlighted the broader work of the organization Church Clarity on this show, making clear the need for people of faith to be able to make informed choices about faith communities in a time of politicization and polarization under the guise of religion. What are the concerns specific to the populations Pride in the Pews focus on right now?
Great, great question. Really, at the heart of the work that we're doing is inviting the church to reconsider its approach to LGBTQIA plus Christians. Our goal ultimately is to ensure that whatever space LGBTQIA Christians step into in the Black church, they are greeted with the love of Christ. Of course, we know the Bible, the gospel is all about meeting marginalized groups and populations where they are, right? And ensuring that they are greeted with the abundant and agape love of Christ. We want churches to be able to do that. We want churches to be able to honor the lived experiences and in some cases trauma of LGBTQIA plus Christians so that they're better able to minister to them, right? So our ultimate goal is around creating safe, right, spiritual homes for queer Christians. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to do that is by starting with love.
Mm. With the disparities that you identify in terms of LGBTQI plus affirming denominations, how do you go about identifying congregations that are supportive?
So this is, I think, an ongoing challenge for Pride in the Pews. And it's one that we wholeheartedly accept. We are specifically focused on historically Black religious traditions. That includes the National Baptist Convention, the Progressive National Baptist Convention, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and more. And there are so many within these denominations or those who are adjacent to these denominations who are really interested in starting this conversation, really interested in taking seriously in honoring the life and sanctity of all of God's children. There are pastors who have reached out to me eagerly, excited to support and excited to get their hands on the resources that we will create. So a lot of it is word of mouth. A lot of it is us really looking at pastors who have been on the front lines of fighting for social justice, because we know that they would be likely partners in advancing justice for all, not just for some.
Hmm. Is this something that may be in defiance of the position of some of these people's work?
You know, I would say if I had to really put a name to it, I don't think that this is done in defiance of their theological position. I think this is actually in line with their theological position. And that is rooted in a love ethic. We all believe that Jesus Christ centers the needs of those who are on the margins and periphery of society. I am inviting the Black church to do the exact same thing when it comes to LGBTQIA plus Christians. So I don't think that we are in opposition to one another. I actually think that we are on the same page. It's a matter of how we express our commitment to the gospel. And I think that by embracing LGBTQIA plus Christians, we are actually embodying the ministry, cause, and mission of Christ. Mm-hmm. And I believe that Black churches and Black pastors across the country want to do the same thing.
You just listed a lot of denominations that are out there. Are you able to do any work with the denominations themselves, raising awareness and showing the kind of harm exclusion is doing?
Thank you so much for that question. And I would answer it like this. We are a grassroots focused organization. So we started with centering the voices of queer Christians, right? That's where we started. We want to share those stories, lift those stories up, create curricula and toolkits and resources, as I've mentioned. And as we do that, we want to raise awareness, right? And also amplify the voices and experiences of folks like me. And in doing so, I will be inviting a little later down the road, denominational bodies to begin to consider the implications of this work and how they might be able to relate to it and support it. But first and foremost, I want folks to know that we exist, We are in these congregations. We are attending Sunday after Sunday. We are in the choirs. We are in the pulpit. We are in the ushers. We are on the ushers board. We are present. And look at the multitude of voices that have already risen up to say, hey, we are here and here's how you can better serve us. So after we have done that extensively through our storytelling project, Can I Get a Witness? I will then approach pastors and preachers and denominational bodies to join our work.
What would be the practical process for someone searching for a faith community? How would an individual engage with Pride in the Pews, and what kind of help can you offer to them?
First and foremost, if you are a Black LGBTQIA+ Christian or a Christian who identifies as queer, we want to invite you to join our work at Pride in the Pews. You can visit us at www.prideinthepews.com. And if you're Black and queer, I encourage you to sign up for our storytelling project. We find that it is incredibly healing for queer Christians to tell their story and to build community with someone who understands their experience. And we're also creating toolkits and curricula and messaging that you'll be able to follow, that you will be able to have access to as you journey toward embodying self-love through the love of Christ. And for those who are allies, maybe even reticent allies, we invite you to reach out to Pride in the Pews, have conversations with us, invite us to your church, invite us to events so that we can begin to talk about the very clear intersections of LGBTQIA plus rights and the religious tradition of the Black Church and Christianity more broadly. We'd love to have that conversation with you. We are open, we are available, and always happy to have an honest, good faith conversation about how we can better meet the needs of those on the margins.
Don, I can tell that you are a vision person. So looking ahead a few years, what would you love to see Pride in the Pews become, and what would you want it to achieve?
Thank you so much for that question. I think as we do the work, it can be so all-consuming. And, you know, having an opportunity to really reflect on the vision and what our ultimate goal is always really wonderful. So what I'm hoping is that Pride in the Pews will be a sustained effort from within the Black Church that holds the Black Church accountable to loving all of God's people with a particular focus on LGBTQIA plus Christians. That means we are hosting conferences. That means that we are gathering coalitions of Black pastors who are affirming and advocating on behalf of LGBTQIA plus Christians. It also means that we are lifting up and creating resources that meet churches where they are, not where we want them to be. Not only that, I would love for Pride in the Pews to be a leading effort, a leading voice in the effort to make historically Black denominations queer affirming, not just on a congregational level, but on positions, right? We want them to be able to take positions publicly and boldly that advocates for and affirms the rights and dignity of LGBTQIA plus Christians. So as I see it, our mission will not stop until we have every single historically Black religious traditions, not on the sidelines, but on the front lines of fighting for LGBTQIA plus rights.
Well, tell us again, please, how they could get in touch with Pride in the Pews and how they can support what your work is.
Yes. So first and foremost, I would invite you to visit www.prideinthepews.com. There you will see opportunities to sign up for our storytelling project. There will also be opportunities for you to give financially to these efforts and support. And you can follow us on social media, Instagram and Facebook at prideinthepews.com. And I would say, most importantly, amplifying this work to your pastor, to your local minister, to for-profit organizations that are interested in supporting this cause. And lastly, amplifying this work to foundations, right? Foundations that are interested in funding this work, supporting this work, because they recognize that we have to ensure that LGBTQIA+ folks across the country have the same rights and the same dignity that is afforded all of our other straight brothers and sisters.
Don Abram is founder of Pride in the Pews, Queering the Black Church, one testimony at a time. Don, thank you so much for being with us today. The enthusiasm in you carries over to our listeners, I'm sure. We are so glad that you were with us on State of Belief Radio. Come back to see us again and let us know how it's going.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's such a privilege to be in conversation with you, and I'm grateful to be able to support the work that you're advancing.
Thank you. Administrations come and go, but it seems attempts to undermine the promise in the U.S. Constitution of religious freedom for all continue in ways great and small, no matter who's in charge. Fighting to defend this foundational principle is Interfaith Alliance. And I am happy to have Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline back with us on State of Belief Radio. I'm always glad when he's here. Welcome back, Jack.
Thank you, Welton. Glad to be here.
You know, I think there's a real risk of complacency right now. At least in this country, the pandemic is becoming less of a paralyzing crisis. At the same time, attempts to control our government is overtly sectarian. Religious terms have receded. But in a way, that can be a dangerous time indeed, because a relieved public can lose focus on the ongoing threats that continue to fester. What are your thoughts about that, Jack?
I think there's such a sense of relief now, Welton, that people may find themselves, let's say, experimenting with normalcy. And it's a little too soon to be doing that in terms of health. And a lot of the progress that we've made on issues that required thought and personal restraint may require a little recalibrating now that we're back interacting with each other with a little bit of abandon.
Right. The new Congress has several initiatives that the Alliance endorses. I'd like for you to talk about the legislative work that's going on there.
Well, we are glad that some of the stuff we were working on in years past that was frustrated by an uncooperative legislative branch is now beginning to see the light of day. The No Ban Act, which prevents the president and the government from restricting the free access to the country for reasons of faith or ethnicity, was passed. We've seen legislation that has helped us to lift up equity as a matter of principle for people in different ethnic and religious communities, as well as people of differing orientations. We've seen that legislation advance. And we are definitely hoping that we will see more guarantees that extend constitutional rights explicitly to people, regardless of what they believe or whom they love. So we're making some progress, and we're happy about that.
I know that Supreme Court cases are critically important to religious freedom advocates. Are there direct ways Interfaith Alliance engages with judicial issues, or is that more of an awareness-raising process?
Well, we have frequently signed on to amicus briefs in cases that we are concerned about, One example of that is a decision that we're awaiting and that will not be issued before this broadcast airs, on the Fulton case, which discusses whether or not, in this particular instance, Catholic foster and adoption agencies can restrict the parentage of wards that are in their care for placement. We, of course, are hoping for an ability for, in this case, the city of Philadelphia, to require any adoption or foster care agency to treat all qualified applicants the same, regardless of their faith or orientation. So we've signed an amicus brief for that. But unless you are arguing the case itself, you have no influence over the court other than to provide supporting materials for the side that you're in favor of. And that's frankly what we've done with all sorts of cases. It gives us a vested interest in the outcome. And I will tell you that I'm prepared at sort of a moment's notice, if we know that this decision is going to be issued, to be down on the steps of the Supreme Court and prepared to answer questions, as always is the case when any opinion is issued. Yeah. So it's business as usual, except for the pandemic restrictions that will prevent a large gathering in front of the court to wait for this decision to be issued.
Yeah. So what are some of the other priorities that have been really keeping you busy?
Well, in terms of our issues, I will tell you that there are three things that are going on right now that the public should be aware of anyway. Congress has declared the month of May, which is slowly coming to an end, to be both Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month and Jewish Heritage Month. So we have been lifting up our allies in both communities and drawing the attention of our membership and the people who follow us on Facebook and Twitter to activities nationally and in their local communities that celebrate the contributions of those communities to the culture and the history and the society of the United States. So those are two of the things we're concerned about. And of course, we're very focused now on June, which is Pride Month, and lifting up the importance of equity and equality for members of the LGBTQI+ population in the United States, with a particular focus on our concern for the treatment of people who are transgender, and among those particularly of children who are transgender. So that's taking a lot of our time and attention, and it's what the people who follow us on social media and through email will hear a lot about in the coming weeks.
You know, Jack, an important part of Interfaith Alliance are the local affiliates, and there are a lot of people who know a lot about the Interfaith Alliance but know virtually nothing about local affiliates that we have in a number of states across this country. Would you talk about why that kind of in-the-field engagement is particularly important in a time when many assaults on religious freedom are happening at the state and local level?
We can say a lot of things on a national level that have general applicability, but it's really the people who are on the ground where laws are being made and enforced on a local level who have the most influence on the quality of life of the people in their communities. Now, I won't embarrass myself by trying to name all of our affiliates, but I can tell you that in places like Des Moines, Iowa, and Denver, Colorado, where two of our strongest and most active affiliates are, Interfaith Alliance of Iowa and Interfaith Alliance of Colorado, the focus on legislation there is intense. And the folks who've been working with those affiliates have not only followed a national agenda for religious freedom, but have also been active voices in building bridges in the interfaith community, as is only possible on a very local level. And then there are places like Fresno, California. The Interfaith Alliance of Central California is one of our strongest advocates of interfaith understanding and collaboration. So in addition to whatever lobbying they might do in Sacramento, which is a state capital, the local community in Fresno and its environs is very active in promoting religious freedom and education about religious freedom in local schools, including universities. We also have a remarkable group in Oklahoma City, the Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma, which has, again, in addition to promoting our legislative concerns in Tulsa, in the state capital, has been involved in providing inclusive alternatives to what are sometimes exclusive public ceremonies. Most recently, the National Day of Prayer, which has a decidedly right-leaning Christian tinge in the United States in general and in Oklahoma City in particular. Our group hosted an alternative that made room not only for people of differing faiths, but people of no faith at all. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of issues that need to be faced by people in the places that they live, not just the places they read about, like we are in inside the Beltway here. We're very grateful for our affiliates. I'll mention one more, and that is one of our newest affiliates in Wyoming, which has hosted a series of remarkable get to know your neighbor webinars that reminds me of what, when you and I were much younger, we used to do on the Interfaith Alliance board. We would bring people in from different faith communities and have them educate our leadership about more than just what the name of their faith community was, but what its tenets and practices were. And that's what Wyoming is doing for a much more diverse population in that state than you might think actually exists. So good stuff going on in the field. And there could be more affiliates if your listeners were interested in banding together, and we'll help them form.
Well, actually, I want to go right there, because you never know. There may have been a listener or two that found attraction to what you were saying. What does it take to start a new affiliate, and what kind of support does Interfaith Alliance offer for folks taking on that kind of project?
Well, Jay Keller, who is our director of field operations, and Maureen O'Leary, who works with him, she's our full-time staff member who divides her time between policy and field, have an entire program to help people who might want to form an Interfaith Alliance affiliate in their locality. And really all it takes is, let's say for the sake of argument, four people with good intentions and a little bit of time on their hands, willing to reach out in more directions than just to each other. A small group of people with a deep dedication can form the nucleus of an affiliate and then begin to reach out to individuals and communities of faith in their city, in their town, in their locality to form a community within a community that will speak on behalf of faith and freedom for all people.
I'm curious, what do you expect will be the focus of your attention as we head into the summer month?
The Biden administration has been very aggressive in pursuing broad initiatives during these first few months of President Biden's time in office, and has a very, very active faith and community-based infrastructure within the White House. And I think that we will still be supporting the president's initiatives to get as many people vaccinated and therefore immune as possible, so the country can begin to go back to its sense of normalcy. But our staff is meeting actually this week, probably by the time this program is aired, we'll have had our first conversations about what the second half of 2021 is going to mean for us. And I think that we will be focusing again on justice initiatives for various communities. We are extremely concerned about the rise of religious and ethnic antagonisms, both on the right and on the left. People may forget that Interfaith Alliance is a defender of the Constitution, not of a political perspective. That may have been lost a little bit in the last administration. But we're seeing now that communities of faith and communities of differing orientation are being targeted from the right and the left. And we will be talking about what kinds of initiatives we can do to make people more aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we have a series of web broadcasts that we will continue independent of whether we're able to go back to live interaction. We found this to be a very effective way to meet people. We have a series coming up on the Fulton decision when it is announced, and on hate crimes, how to identify them and what to do about them. And I hope that we will set loose early in the fall a second season of the American Purpose webcasts that we did earlier this spring.
Good. Jack, for a moment, I guess I just want to be selfish because I want to divert from this conversation, moved by the deep concern that I have because of the crisis of anti-Semitism that has sickened me and scores of others in recent days. Rapid meanness fills the air and the streets. I know there is so much to talk about here, but I just want you, because I've done this before when it's just you and I talking, but I want to ask you to just say whatever you want to say, what you would say to people like me who hate this anti-Semitic tsunami that's hit us.
Like any kind of bigotry, Welton, whether it's racism or the anti-Asian bigotry that we're seeing or the anti-Muslim bigotry that we've seen, anti-Semitism is something that flourishes only when it goes unchallenged. And honestly, it is not the Jewish community's responsibility to combat anti-Semitism any more than it's the Muslim community's responsibility to combat bigotry against them or the Asian community bigotry against them. It takes people of goodwill, like the fantastic coalition we have in Interfaith Alliance, to stand up for any community in the United States or anywhere in the world that is suffering from behavior associated with prejudice and hatred. I am a rabbi, as you introduced me, and so it sometimes feels to me a little self-serving when I speak out strongly about anti-Semitism the way I have to at this moment because we've had this spike. So what is so important to the Jewish community, I can tell you, is that we have allies like you and allies in other faith communities who will be as outspoken in objecting to this kind of behavior, this kind of hatred and bigotry, as we at Interfaith Alliance are for every other faith community, regardless of whether they are liberal or conservative, whether they're Western or Eastern, or whether they hold any faith beliefs at all. We're all in this together. And just you asking that question, Welton, is a good first step in reminding people that they have the responsibility to protect everybody's faith and freedom in this country.
Thank you. Jack, are you feeling hopeful about the direction our country is now headed in, both on the religious freedom front and on more broad fronts?
You know, that's a fair question because it's the question I ask at the end of each of my American Purpose episodes of somebody else. So now I have to answer it for myself, right? I'm hopeful that as people begin to breathe freely again, and I say that both literally and metaphorically, there will be a renewed ability to focus on something other than our immediate needs. And I hope that, to use sort of a metaphor here, President Biden's focus on infrastructure in the United States, physical infrastructure, will inspire people to think about our moral infrastructure as well, and to really make it possible for people to begin communicating again, even in disagreement, in ways that they used to in the Bush and Clinton administrations, in a way that we began to lose during the Obama administration and that completely fell apart during the Trump administration. I think that there is a possibility of openness now despite some of the extremist voices we're still hearing on the right and the left, I think there's an openness now to listening to each other and making some real progress. So I am cautiously optimistic.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, defending true religious freedom for all. Jack, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Be well, Welton, and all of our listeners as well.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.